Thank you very much. Our fourth speaker for this session is Bruno Larue from Laval. Bruno holds a CRC chair in international attitude trade. He's also a McGill graduate, a graduate from the Faculty of Agriculture and Farmland Studies. I just thought I'd throw that in. he's also director of a center for research on the economics of the environment, agri-food, transports and energy, which brings together researchers from Laval, McGill University, Carleton, University of Ottawa, and also the University of Macedonia. His major research interests are currently in the area of trade liberalization, economics of non-tariff barriers, and interactions between trade and domestic agricultural policies.
Thank you for the nice introduction. I have fond memories of McGill. I was 18 when I started my undergraduate studies here. So that's a long time ago. Back then, I could leave Belleuil, the South Shore of Montreal, and be downtown in less than half an hour driving. And it's not because my car was going faster than my car today. Basically, the gist of my talk is about how international trade is an important part of the solution to food security concerns, and how actually it's being misused. The challenge of food security is huge. We're failing actually a lot of people, 925 million. It's a global issue, so when we talk to people about this, they think right away about famines, and of course, these are tragic events, but it's more global than that. Of course, it affects even big cities and the industrial world, even beautiful Montreal. And I think that agricultural economists have quite a bit to say to contribute, because there are a lot of what I would call specificities about ag market are important when we develop policies. And so I'll relate, I'll explain that and then relate that to what's going on with what we do with trade policies. So what's special about agricultural commodities? Well, the main thing is that production and marketing decisions are separated in time, sometimes by years. If you think about a cattle producer, the moment the calf is born and the moment the steer is marketed, well, there's about 24 months, a 24-month period. So prices can change quite a bit in 24 months. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of adjustment you can do in terms of the supply once you've committed to your production decision. So markets are slow to adjust because of that. Production is also affected by weather and diseases. So there's uncertainty coming this way. The marketing window is typically short because we're talking about perishable products. It's an area where there's been a lot of technological change. And input supplies and processing and food distribution and retail, there's been tremendous economies of scale that we've witnessed at the farm level as well. There's a paper on dairy economics not too long ago that said that even farms that have 10,000 dairy cows still face economies of scale. So because of that, what happened, the basic structure typically is that we've got these farmers that buy inputs from a few firms and sell their outputs to a few firms. And that may create what we call hold-up problems that tend to degenerate into low price and low capacity traps. The problem being that the buyers have market power and have no incentive to bid up prices because the output is essentially fixed in the short run. So farmers anticipate that and will produce that all. So what are the way around this? Well, we're witnessing the development of value chains where buyers are actually contracting, making credible commitments toward farmers to give them higher prices. And the other solution is more like the Canadian solution, and that's to farmers to fight for the control of the marketing mechanism. So we have collective approach to marketing commodities. We see that, of course, in supply management, production. But we also see that, for example, in the hog business in Quebec, where a processor, for example, that is also a producer, has to go through the federation to buy and eventually process its own hogs. And of course, even out west, the latest vote on the future of the meat board is quite telling, where 62% of the people voted to preserve the Canadian meat board. I'm not trying to be an apologist for collective marketing mechanism, but I'm just trying to tell you what drives these things. In less developed countries, of course, it's even worse, because in many instances, farmers are not aware of all the possibilities of price differences that could be arbitrage. Of course, the development of cell phones is changing that, so making markets a bit more efficient. But basically, unlike other more normal, I would say, commodities, non-ag commodities, supply is still going to adjust. So you've seen floods like this very often, probably in the recent months. The pink line is the corn price, the orange line is the hog price, and the blue line is the food oil price. So you can see the spikes in the corn price. The first thing that we notice is that volatility is nothing new. So if I were to go back, further back in time, we would see a lot of volatility. The other thing is that it's not all commodities, of course, that have prices trending upward. So if you look at the hog price, actually it's trending actually a bit downward. What's interesting is that if you look at what happened in the fall of 2010, the price of corn is shooting up and the price of hog is going down, and rather fast. So does that mean that markets don't work and that there's no such thing as cost push effect? The answer is no. But the thing is, there's more factors influencing hog prices than just feeding costs. So the commodity, actually the analysis of commodity prices is actually more complicated than what people that take an Econ 101 might think. The other thing that other people have said is that the price of crude oil is and the price of corn are linked. We did studies on this. What we find out is that the price of crude oil and corn are what we call pointigrated, and that's a relatively recent phenomenon. Started in the late 1990s. It was not before, so that means that the shocks from the oil sector, the energy sector, are transmitted directly to the corn sector. But the reverse is not true, because crude oil is what we call weekly exogenous. So that contributes to the volatility that we've seen. Now, in terms of long-term perspective, land is a necessary input. And so if you look at those trends of arable land endowments, they're trending downwards for most regions. That might be surprising, given that we've seen high prices for some commodities recently, and yet in Asia, Europe, North America, it's trending downward. So that means that if we're going to increase our food supply in the future, it's going to have to come from higher productivity. The positive development is that we see an upward trend in Africa in terms of arable land. The thing about food is that demand is relentless. We have to eat every day, hopefully three times a day. We have 7 billion people to feed, possibly 9 billion in 2045. So it's a tall order. The other thing that is changing is that when countries are developing, the demand for processed product is increasing. We see it in the trade statistics. Trade in processed products is increasing a lot faster than trade in primary products. And there's a new thing, or a relatively new thing, is that there's a demand for crops for other purposes than food. So that puts some more pressure. Consumer behavior, because people, of course, can adopt defensive measure about their own food insecurity. The main thing is that people can substitute. But you can substitute only if you have choices. Okay. Food prices are generally less volatile than commodity prices. The main reason is that the commodity component in the cost of processed food is relatively small, so even if that commodity prices vary quite a bit, then food prices tend to vary less. But even at the retail level, we see some major, major changes from week to week. I mean, I do grocery with my wife. She's also a professor and interested in food issues, and so we have a professional and personal interest in this thing. And I was noticing the price of pasta going from basically a dollar for a package of 1 kilogram 1 week to $3.50 the next week. And so we're, as consumers, we can deal with those big price increases because we can substitute. We can store a little bit. But basically, if we look at our food budget, it's pretty stable. But it's because we have choices. And we have choices in part because we have access to supermarkets that are very good at giving us choices. These people are very good at sourcing foods from all over the place, and they do it cheaply. So the fact that the number of supermarkets increasing in LDC is certainly a positive trend, but even in the rich world, the poor always faces a limited choice set, and so cannot be as good in terms of implementing defensive strategy. Implication for ag trade, because there are huge differences in productivities across country, one would think that the gains from trade, the gains from exploiting comparative advantage must be huge. And so why don't we do it? In fact, we don't, because agriculture is heavily protected. The average ag tariff is often 4 or 5 times higher than the average tariff on non-ag commodities. The countries that have most gains are the small ones, because they're the ones that will face the most different prices as we liberalize. The point with agriculture is that we have to make sure we're sending the right signals to producers, because we get stuck with production decisions. So once the grain is planted, the wheat is planted, if the price doubles, we're not going to be able to double our production. Early work I've done with other people early on in my career show that trade barriers exacerbate price volatility. So that's bad. And basically, we went from a situation where export subsidies were a problem in the 1980s to a situation where export taxes were a problem. I'll skip that. Okay, policy reactions to high commodity prices. Basically, a lot of countries have banned exports or tax exports. I mean, some have been smarter, like Chile, like providing targeted consumer assistance, but a lot of tax exports and contributing to making prices even higher. From a purely selfish national welfare perspective, of course, that's bad policy. Because it's when export prices are high that you can get the most from the gains from trade. So what you would want then is to encourage your firm to export so that you can actually import more. And these countries were depriving their citizens from these gains from trade. Now there's some very recent analysis being done that showed that it's the countries that had a higher food per capita availability that were more prone to intervene. It's also countries that where government were close to a re-election and were more prone to intervene. Surprisingly, countries with more democratic government or freer media or having experienced protest riots were not more likely to intervene. So that's from actually a paper I'm reviewing. So the results have not been rubber stamped yet, but it's certainly quite telling. The problem is that, the way I see it, export taxes are legal in the WTO. And so countries can do pretty much what they want. They can even use quantitative restrictions under some conditions. It's all legal, provided that they notify. As far as I know, none of the countries that have intervened like that have notified the WTO. And unfortunately, for the moment, nothing can be done about it because the negotiations are stalled. So we won't have some sort of institutional failure here. Now, the worst thing that could happen is that those protectionist policies might convince importers to use more protectionist policies to boost up their domestic production. If we do that, we lose all the gains from the comparative advantage. And so if all countries do that, and we start having crop failures here and there because of bad weather and so forth, or flooding, prices will be a lot higher than they are today. So it's unfortunately, the sort of policy that we've seen are not helping. And I think it's because food supply is so slow to adjust that we have actually to have liberal and predictable policy if we're to be serious about food security. Thank you.